This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, is there other life out there in our universe? We'll find out why the answer may not matter, but the ongoing search remains essential for all of us. Now, we're taking a look at perceived liberal bias on college campuses. Last month, the State Assembly Committee on Colleges and Universities held a public meeting questioning whether liberal bias in the UW system was hurting students' education. Some lawmakers suggested including political ideology as part of diversity and equity initiatives. And this week, UW System President Jay Rothman said that students should be challenged and that hiring from diverse backgrounds will help address the perceived liberal echo chambers of college. We're talking about liberal bias on college campuses, and you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Are you a college student or parent of a college student? And what are your thoughts on liberal bias on campus? What have you seen and heard? Call us, 1-800-642-1234. Certainly in the news today, you can email us ideas at WPR.org. Joining us, Corrine Hess, K-12 education reporter for WPR. And Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so the Republican majority legislature, in addition to critiquing a perceived liberal bias at UW, has also expressed some concerns, as we heard in the news there, about funding ongoing diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives at the UW system. Put this in some perspective for us. What is the speaker calling for?
Well, the speaker this week has said that, you know, there could be potential budget cuts if the UW system doesn't phase out the diversity, equity, and inclusion offices at its campuses. He has said that the university has gone from being an institute of higher education to indoctrinating students. And so, you know, all of this is happening at a time when UW-Madison students right now are protesting this video that came out of another student's racist rants. So it's just all happening at the same time.
Yes. UW System President Jay Rothman weighed in earlier this week speaking to WPR on Monday. What did he have to say about the diversity, equity, and inclusion of initiatives along with political diversity on UW campuses?
He says he's committed to educating a diverse group of students, and he wants them to be exposed to professors who represent a range of cultures, ideas, and opinions. So, you know, he says that with the DEI goals, he wants to really focus on the I, which stands for inclusion, when he hires people.
And the president's comments come after this recent survey, at least the release of the survey, where we find a majority of conservative students said they censor them, at least who responded, say they censor themselves in class. Do we have any specifics on this, or what do the numbers say?
Well, yeah, the survey, I think, was pretty eye-opening to people that work on campuses and, you know, parents and others. It said that more conservative students feel like they can't speak out on topics of abortion or trans issues. And so so I think that's where a lot of this is coming from.
And so what ideas then has the UW system president put forth for increasing political diversity on UW system in the UW system and specifically in professors?
Well, you know, when I talked to him, he didn't really want to talk about increasing political diversity. Okay. I think he wants to stay above that. He was talking about increasing diversity on campus, like by hiring maybe more veterans or people who come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. He said that, you know, he comes from a business background. He worked at a law firm for more than 30 years before coming into academics. So he talked more about just wanting to create campuses where people can express themselves. I asked him how to do that. And, you know, right now, I think he's just meeting with legislators, educators, students, trying to figure that out, because I think it's a really hard question.
Yeah. Corey, I appreciate you detailing it for us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Corey Hess, our K-12 reporter for WPR, talking to us about the University of Wisconsin's response to the state legislature's concern over perceived liberal bias within the system. And now we're going to take a look at why there's such a strong perception of liberal bias at universities in the first place and whether the data actually backs that up. Our next guest is Neil Gross, a professor of sociology at Colby College and the author of books including Why Are Professors Liberal and What Do Why Do Conservatives Care? His latest book is Walk the Walk, How Three Police Chiefs Defied the Odds and Changed Cop Culture. He also got his PhD at UW-Madison. So, Neil, welcome back to Madison and welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, what does the data say? What do we know about the political political bents on campus?
Well, to speak to the faculty piece first, because it's that's different than the student part of it or the question of what staff are doing or saying on college campuses. You know, I think you have to think about two different elements. Like one is what are the political views of the faculty? And then second, to what extent are they injecting those political views into their teaching? You know, on that question of what are their politics? Yeah, I mean, I think the data back up what most people know, which is that academia is a pretty progressive occupation. Certainly, very strong support in academia for the Democrats. There's some variation across fields, of course. The social sciences and humanities tend to be the most left-leaning. The closer you get to more applied fields, they tend to be a little bit more favorable to conservatives, but overall, very progressive occupation. But on the question of what people do in classrooms, that's another matter altogether. And there, you know, I think that we don't have strong evidence to suggest that there's a lot of political indoctrination happening, at least in the classroom.
So what does the taking a look at the political ideologies of college professors, so is there more education equate with a more liberal political point of view?
There's lots of questions as to kind of why this is true. It's not true just now. I mean, the progressivism of the faculty has been growing a little bit over time. If you compare numbers from the early 2000s to today, you see that there's a slightly higher percentage of the faculty that describe themselves as on the far left, a slightly smaller share describe themselves as conservative. But you know, if you go back to the 1950s, the 1960s, higher education faculty have always been more progressive. And yeah, part of the answer is education. I think there's other hypotheses people roll out for a while. There's a lot of talk about discrimination against conservatives applying for jobs in academia. Not strong evidence, at least when I was doing my research in the early 2000s to back that up. But what I think there is evidence for is the idea that academia has, for a long time, had a reputation as a liberal space, going all the way back to early struggles over academic freedom when folks on the left kind of found a home for themselves in the professoriate. And I think that reputation has just grown over time. And so now you get a lot of self-selection, right? A lot of young people who are academically motivated, academically accomplished. If they're on the left, they think, hey, you know, university career, that's a job where I could see myself. A lot of young conservatives who are academically motivated and talented think that space is just not for me. So I think the biggest driver of it is self-selection.
Interesting. Neil Gross, our guest professor of sociology at Colby College, who has taken a look at the politics of college campuses. And you can join us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. So I see this survey from last year from the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression that found 15% of college faculty identify as independents. Just over 30% identify as Democrats, and conservatives would be underrepresented in this, but there's not actually a liberal majority here. So if how would you size up these numbers and of political perspective on campus and these professors, and aren't we seeing indoctrination in the classroom if there is this political bent then, Neil?
You know, I think that the question of kind of what happens in college classrooms, it's always been kind of a black box from the standpoint of thinking about politics and higher ed. We've known for some time that the experience of going to college tends to make people a little bit more liberal socially. For a long time, the evidence suggested that going to college actually made people more conservative on economic matters. Now, the more recent data suggests that there's now a shift and that it tends to make people a little bit more liberal, both socially and on economic matters. But I think the main reason that the politics don't bleed over that much into the classroom is because an awful lot of what happens in the classroom, it doesn't have anything to do with politics. You know, research my book, I spent a lot of time talking to natural scientists, you know, chemists and biologists, and they all say some version of I ask, you know, what role do politics play in your teaching? They'd say, look, a rock, you know, doesn't have a molecule, doesn't have politics. I think there's this idea out there that every college classroom, we're just sitting around debating liberal versus conservative ideas. For the most part, we're trying to communicate the content of our field to students. And yeah, we're trying to get them to think, develop their own critical thinking skills. But I think one of the big reasons that that college classrooms aren't a site of more mobilization in terms of shaping people's political views is that that's not the bulk of what happens in the classroom. And then the other piece of it is, you know, students, I wish that they did, but they don't pay that much attention to what professors say, right? The bulk of what happens in students' experiences is, you know, what happens where they live, it's who they interact with, it's their peers. And if there's a movement to the left among people who go to college, a big part of it is that experience rather than what happens in the classroom.
Neil Gross, our guest, professor of sociology at Colby College, author of Why Are Professors Liberal and Why Do Conservatives Care? We're taking a look at the political persuasions on college campuses, and we invite you to the conversation. Do you think political ideology should be taken into account when considering the overall diversity of college faculty? Do you think it's true that there's liberal bias among college professors? And if so, why does that matter? 800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue with our guest, Neil Gross, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our talk with Neil Gross, professor and chair of sociology at Colby College and author of the book, Why Are Professors Liberal and Why Do Conservatives Care? We're taking a look at the political persuasion of people on college campuses, from students to professors to staff. And we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Do you think universities should make an effort to hire more conservative faculty? 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And Neil, I'm curious if your research helps explain at all the recent UW student survey that found that students who identify as conservatives, the majority of them feel to some degree censored or unable to present their own opinions in the classroom. Is there any explanation that you found, a good explanation for this?
You know, it's interesting. That survey points to a finding which I think is worth paying attention to, and that is that that faculty, by and large, hold views about censorship in college classrooms that is much less censorious than the views of students themselves. In other words, if you ask faculty, you know, should people with diverse views, with extreme views in some cases, be allowed to speak on campus? You know, should they be allowed to, should professors with views that are out of the mainstream be allowed to teach their classes without being disciplined? Faculty, by and large, say yes. It's students who are more willing to want to issue reprisals against those extreme speakers. So I think that it's certainly the case that some students fear that faculty might mark them down if they express opinions that don't align with what they perceive to be the faculty opinion. But based on my experience, the biggest thing is peer culture. Students are worried about what their peers will think of them, what they'll say to them, and how that will affect their reputation on campus.
The percentage of UW-Madison students who identify as Black alone at UW-Madison has never surpassed 3% of the student body during a school year. But as our student body continues to become more diverse, what does that mean for the politics of students as they enter the university and campus, Neil?
You know, I think it's the case that that in general, people with more education are becoming more liberal these days. You know, we talk about the politics of the professoriate, but if you look at trends in the politics of lawyers, doctors, you know, anyone with an advanced degree, and increasingly people with college degrees, they're trending more and more toward the Democratic Party. And, you know, to your question about diversity, I mean, I think that you know, there's lots of questions about whether growing, you know, racial and ethnic diversity, kind of what the effects of that will be on the political composition of different groups. And you know, I think it's a little hard to tell at a place like Madison. I mean, we know that new generations of students that are coming in are typically much more progressive. They get to college much more progressive. It's not as though faculty are making them more progressive. And that there's a growing distaste, I would say, for the GOP among students, kind of regardless of their racial or ethnic identities. Of course, that's not across the board. There are plenty of conservative students, but their numbers have been dwindling.
You wrote in the New York Times about the Republican Party's move to the right since the 1980s. What role has that played in, if at all, that you found in the politics of college campuses?
So I like to think about this in branding terms, right? So if you're a software manufacturer, a software company, and you find that some important group of consumers is falling away from your soft drink, one thing that you can do is I guess you can blame the consumers and go after them and try to get new consumers in the market. But another thing you can do is you can fix the soft drink so it's more appealing to consumers. And I think what I was trying to suggest in that piece is that as the Republican Party has veered more toward the right, particularly toward the populist right, but on social issues, on climate change, and so on, it's become increasingly distasteful to people with more advanced educations. I think to imagine that the solution to that is to somehow hire a conservative faculty when it's not clear that there's even a pool of conservative faculty to draw from, is to miss the point. And that probably if the GOP wanted more faculty members to support the Republican Party, wanted more students to support the Republican Party, it would probably be wise for them to reconsider what it is that RAND is doing.
Do you find in your research, have you found any hiring bias against conservatives from colleges and universities?
So in my own studies of this, which were done back around 2010 or so, I conducted audit studies looking at whether faculty members were more likely to be enthusiastic about conservative graduate students. Again, the evidence suggests that the problem of overrepresentation of progressive faculty, to the extent that it's a problem, is really one of self-selection. So at every stage of the pipeline, college students more liberal, graduate students far more liberal. When it comes to hiring faculty, again, there just aren't that many conservative faculty that you could go to hire. So we looked to see whether there was discrimination among people who were against people who were applying to graduate school. We didn't find any. I think there have been some subsequent studies that have suggested that maybe things have shifted a little bit, but the basic problem is there just aren't very many conservative graduate students. And so again, who would you hire exactly?
Neil Gross, our guest, professor of sociology at Colby College and author of books including Why Are Professors Liberal and Why Do Conservatives Care? Taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Miriam in Milwaukee. Miriam, good afternoon.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wish to say that I think you're both missing the boat really quite badly. I don't think it's a matter of conservative politics or liberal politics, Republican or Democrat. I think it's a matter of how, begin quote, woke, end quote, you are, whether you toe the line in terms of gender criticism or not. I have friends who are teachers in non-liberal arts colleges. One was teaching a nursing class, another a science class, who, because they expressed gender critical views, not in their classroom and not on college campus, but in, their own, like, say, Facebook page or whatever, we're terminated. I think that gender criticism is the big bugaboo now. And as I see it, I was a teacher for 37 years, and as I see it, I wouldn't make it today. I see freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of association going down the tubes. Recently, I was in Madison, and we were doing a Let Women Speak, which is not anti-transgender. And we were threatened. We had people threaten our lives. We had people spit on us. We had people, these were allegedly college students. Come on. It isn't a matter of liberal or conservative. It's a matter of, do you believe that men can be women and women can be men?
Okay, let's ask Neil Gross. Is this a matter of gender criticism and the debate over people's identity?
If you look back at the history of the talk about concerns about what's happening on college campuses, again, it goes way back. Again, you look in the 40s, you can look in the 50s, you can look in the 60s. It's always been the case that folks on the right have found something about what's happening on college campuses that they find objectionable. There's lots of reasons for why this is. It is true that colleges are more progressive spaces. It's also the case that that kind of talk serves a really important function for the Republican Party, and that is that it provides an elite that the GOP can rally against. It helps to kind of bolster its populist credentials. And look, there's no question that I think most college faculty believe that That people should be free to express views that are, you know, as long as they're kind of respectful of the community. But, you know, I think this is, you know, essentially a false issue. The problems on college campuses in terms of teaching students are, you know, is there a tremendous problem with alcohol consumption? Are classes enormous? Can students afford textbooks? Can they afford to go to college? Like, those are the things that are affecting whether students learn and go on to become productive members of society and, you know, can do all sorts of important things. Not that you have to be college educated to be comfortable with society, but you know, those are the things that are going to affect whether we have an educated workforce moving forward. You know, these kinds of culture war issues are really a distraction.
Thank you, Neil. And we've got a couple minutes left here, but with the time we have, I want to ask you about how this affects outside of academia. The 2017 Gallup poll found that Republicans have significantly less confidence in higher education than Democrats. What are the repercussions of this beyond the college campus?
You know, I think the social science on this suggests that when groups of people perceive that that an occupation is heavily tilted in one direction or the other politically, and when they perceive that the politics of that occupation creep into the work, then they tend to have less trust in it. In fact, I think there's a recent study that shows, so it's just that looking at a whole range of occupations. You know, I think American higher education is doing pretty well in terms of the content of the teaching, certainly in terms of the research, the technology spillover, that kind of thing. I think we have to do a better job making clear to the broad public that, you know, we serve an important function, that we're not there to indoctrinate your kids, that we're there to teach them and do critical research. I think that there's a really important communications function. And I think, you know, part of that is a question of transparency, like come into a classroom, see what it actually looks like. I think for a lot of people who are concerned about questions of indoctrination, they'd find, you know, colleges, the classroom itself is it's an educative space. It's not the kind of space of political indoctrination, by and large, that people are concerned about.
Hey, Neil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Neil Gross, professor of sociology at Colby College, author of Why Are Professors Liberal and Why Do Conservatives Care? His new book is Walk the Walk, The Three Police Chiefs That Defied the Odds and Changed Cop Culture, talking to us today about perceived liberal bias on college campuses. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent's joined by members of a Washington County task force who are developing solutions to the steep enrollment declines at the UW-Milwaukee's Washington County campus. And also tomorrow morning, more on Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's proposal to eliminate the offices of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the UW system. That's coming up tomorrow morning with Kate Archer-Kent here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up after 6 tonight on 1A+, the story of art without men. Art historian Kate Hessel joins Jen White to highlight the work of women artists from the 16th century to today. Now, ever since human beings figured out there were other planets in our galaxy, some have wondered, is there life on those other planets? With the latest technology and a growing body of research, we know the answer is maybe. But our next guest says there's good news. Even if answers seem to be eternally around the corner, the search for ways to detect life in the universe tells us a lot about ourselves and the planet we live on. In her new book, she explores the worlds and science of science and science fiction, research and imagination to learn more about what makes life on Earth unique, at least so far. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. What is your favorite portrayal of alien life in a science fiction book or movie? Do you think there's life on other planets? And do you have questions for our guest about the different kinds of research looking for that kind of life? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jamie Green's a science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you spend a lot of time talking to actual scientists in the book, but you also focus a lot on science fiction and imagination when it comes to what alien life might be. Why was that such an important factor for what you wrote?
The way that I wanted to approach things in the book was not just looking at sci-fi as imaginings and science as potential facts, but as all of this as like one big imaginative project. And so I think that like putting the science and the sci-fi together shows us all the different ways that we imagine the possibilities of life beyond Earth. And it's obvious that science fiction is imaginative, But if you look at science also, like, even something as fundamental as making a hypothesis is a kind of imagination. It's about prediction and thinking, you know, what might happen. And designing an experiment requires a lot of imagination. And so I wanted to look at the different angles that we come at this question from.
But the big disconnect I see between science and science fiction is I look at a science fiction universes like those of Star Wars and Star Trek, and it's full of teeming with life. It's everywhere you look, it seems like. Every, you know, planet has some sort of trouble that Captain Kirk needs to find a way out of. So why might life be less abundant than science fiction would like to imagine?
Well, I mean, yeah, science fiction is full of life because otherwise it would be some pretty boring stories. It's like, oh, we were in a spaceship for 3 years and then we turned around and came home, which granted, there are some amazing stories that are like that too, but those are stories about people, you know. I mean, first of all, there's the fact that we haven't found anything yet, that no one has shown up on our doorstep. Of course, there are lots of reasons for that. It could be like in Star Trek, there's this rule about the prime directive. And if we haven't reached a sufficient technology level yet, everyone's just kind of going to leave us alone to find our own path. There's also the possibility that life is just pretty rare. There are scientific reasons for this. You know, it seems like life on Earth did emerge pretty quickly in terms of, you know, once the environment was what life needed, life showed up pretty quick. But that was simple life. That was simple single-celled life like bacteria. And then it took another 2 billion years, that's billion with a B, for life to evolve complexity. And I don't just mean multicellularity. I mean complexity within a cell, structures like the nucleus, which then made it possible for various reasons for life to evolve into structural complexity, into multicellular organisms with bodies and, you know, plants and animals and all of that. 2 billion years is a lot of rolling the dice and waiting for the lucky things to happen that made that possible. And the more we learn about how life figured out that kind of structural complexity, it seems like it might have been kind of a fluke.
So, Jamie, I'm curious about this running theme in your book, that even if we don't discover life outside of Earth anytime soon, it raises big questions about life here on Earth, about humanity itself, us. What are some of your favorite earthly discoveries that have come from the search for alien life?
Ooh, that's a really cool question. I can sort of answer that personally, where I set out to write a book about the search for life beyond Earth, and in the process learned a ton about life on Earth myself. You know, I came at this with more of a background in astronomy. I'm not a scientist. I'm a writer by training, but I had been writing about astronomy and exoplanets and things like that for years. Biology, on the other hand, was pretty new to me. I mean, you know, I took it in high school, but I had never really written about it. And so in order to understand the ways we imagine life on other worlds, and in order to, like, figure out the right questions to ask, I had to learn about things like convergent evolution, which is the phenomenon we see on Earth that distantly related organisms often will evolve similarly, you know, whether it's the body shapes of dolphins and sharks, they found that independently, or human eyes and octopus eyes are structurally very similar and evolve totally independently. This is one of the most interesting questions in evolution. Is this convergence where separate organisms, separate branches of the tree of life come up with the same solutions to the problems of evolution, how to use light to see your environment, how to swim, how to fly. Is that the rule, or are those just interesting exceptions and evolution is really random? You know, if an ancient fish had eaten that worm instead of the other worm, everything would have turned out differently, you know? And we really don't know this. It's a huge debate in evolutionary biology. And so I think that's a really cool open question that reveals so much about life on Earth and the sort of meaning that we make of it, and is also vital to how we imagine life on other worlds, because we'd be completely unrelated. You know, a shark and a dolphin, you go far enough back, they do have a common ancestor. But me and an alien on another world, no common ancestor. Is there reason to think that they would look like us, walk like us, think like us? It all comes back to these questions of how evolution works.
Jamie Green, science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. Brian in Madison, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask, so I recently read Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama, which is a fantastic book. And it's all about just the main conflict is trying to learn as much as we can before time runs out. I think a more like up-to-date version of that would be the movie Arrival. The main conflict is just we don't have much time to try to figure this out. There's no actual like conflict, like space fights. So I just wanted to ask, you know, why is that construct more rare in science fiction as opposed to like your Star Wars is? And what does that say about us?
Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, that is an awesome question. And I definitely think that Arrival, or the story that it's based on, The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang, fits into that. I also think Stanislav Lem's Solaris fits into that as well, where the alien presence, the alien entity, is unknowable. And that's a big part of it. And it's about humans trying to bridge this impossible to bridge gap. And I think we don't see that very often because those stories they're not as dynamic. They're not big battle set pieces. It was an amazing fluke that Arrival was as big a hit as it was, because it's a quiet, weird movie. And in the story, you don't ever find out why the aliens came at all. They're completely opaque and unknowable, and even more so for Solaris, where no one can communicate with this alien entity. I think we want stories very often about relationships between people, whether those people are human or alien. You know, we all learn in elementary school that conflict is the foundation of narrative, and it can be person to person or person against themselves, et cetera, et cetera. These stories with an unknowable alien, it's like person against a brick wall. And that's fascinating. And it can be very poetic and very moving, but it's especially for movies. And I know there've been like multiple film adaptations of Solaris. People figure it out, but it's not the sort of traditional story, conflict-driven story arc that we're used to.
Jamie Green, our guest, and we're taking a look at life out there and life right here in our backyard. She is the author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. We'll take your calls. Want to hear from you. How likely do you think it is that there is life on other planets, and how far away might it be? How about intelligent life on other planets? And do you have a favorite science fiction version of what alien life might be like? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. We continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation about the search for life outside the universe, lessons from science and science fiction, and what it tells us about what it means to be human. Jamie Green, our guest, her new book is The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Let's continue with your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Dan in La Crosse is standing by. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon. Regarding science, the American Scientific Affiliation. Regarding literature, C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. Regarding poetry, my poem, Evolve Me, Jesus. And regarding music, the Martian spaceship landed. Alien said, please, take us to your Sparta butter, Westby cottage cheese, and the cheddar moon. Cheddar moon.
Dan from La Crosse giving us a message to those. And mentioning Westby, which I think it was a Wisconsin original. It reminds me of some of the songs we've sent out into space and some of the signals we've sent to try to contact any life that might be out there, Jamie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is hot debate about whether we should be sending signals, not only listening for them. You know, since about 1960, on and off, we've been searching for radio signals that we might receive, either intentionally sent or sort of overheard from other technological civilizations, but there have also been some messages sent out. Some of them were beamed radio messages, like the Arecibo message, which was sent out from the Arecibo telescope before, long before it unfortunately collapsed in the last couple of years. And we've also sent some physical messages, like the Voyager Golden Records. These were literal golden phonograph records, just like a message in a bottle that were stuck to the side of the Voyager probes that were launched in 1977. And this was a project overseen by Carl Sagan when NASA realized that these probes, after they completed their observational mission in the outer solar system, were just going to keep going. And so Sagan and his eventual wife, Andrian, and a small team put together this record of images, some scientific diagrams, some pictures of life on Earth, and music and whale song and greetings in 150 language. There's also a recording of a child's laughter. It was Sagan's young son, and a recording of Andrian's brainwaves while she did an hour-long meditation on the state of our planet and humanity's struggles against, you know, our violent tendencies and all the hope that she felt for us nonetheless.
Dan, if the aliens land, I'm sending them straight to you in La Crosse. Thank you for the call. Jamie Green, our guest, let's continue with your calls now. Ryan in Glendale joins us. Ryan, good afternoon.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's a really provocative discussion. One of my favorite science fiction stories is Contact by Carl Sagan.
Yes.
And I really appreciate it because it looks at both sides of these implications of contacting other life forms, both the scientific and the faith side. And it doesn't come down on either side. It doesn't treat it as a zero-sum game. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on some of the philosophical implications of life on other planets.
Brian, thank you. And Jamie, you write about this in The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos.
Yeah, I mean, Contact is definitely one of the – Carl Sagan is obviously a huge presence in the book and an inspiration to me, and especially through Contact, because I agree it's a fascinating imagined version of what might happen and how Sagan thought it might happen and what it might mean to humans. And it's also his way of grappling with the power that the religious right had in politics at the time, as well as our search for some sort of spiritual meaning through science. And what's fascinating to me is that at the end of the book, and this isn't really a spoiler, and also the book is very old, so I trust that I'm not ruining anything, but we get this direct proof that in a way, in the world of the book, God is real, that a message has been encoded in the digits of pi, which means that, like, there is a message in the fabric of the universe. And I actually write about this in the book, that when I encountered that, I was like, that's really weird. Sagan's been writing against the sort of, you know, religious struggle against science. And he's very much interested in looking for the numinous, the meaningful, the spiritual. But like, why would he say God is real? And I was able to talk to Andrew and his widow and collaborator on Contact and Cosmos and many other projects. And she said that it's about looking for that sense of meaning and connection that we can find through science, through understanding the universe more deeply, that it's not a religious God, it's not a human God, but it's the sense that there is something deeper than we can comprehend, but it's accessible through science and math.
It sounds like you're describing quantum physics.
Yeah, a little bit.
Rich in Two Rivers joins us next. Rich, you're on the air with Jamie Green.
Hey, Jamie. I'm interested in something I just read about recently, which is Mars was actually occupied by, it had a living biosphere, and they're picking up radio isotopes that they can't pick, that you don't pick up unless there was nuclear warfare. And the next claim was they ended up going to the Earth because of the planet was destroyed.
That we are the Martians and that Mars was blown up by a nuclear war. Does this say more about us or life elsewhere outside of planet Earth, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with any sort of scientific consensus about there being proof of a past nuclear war on Mars. It sounds like, you know, some of the ways that we try to make sense of anomalous findings, you know, when we find radioisotopes that don't quite make sense, it looks like what nuclear war looks like. But there are so many chemical and geological phenomena that we don't know about yet. So this is one of those questions of imagination, that when we see something truly strange, we sort of interpret it like a mirror through the lens of our own experience. You know, so far, there has been no solid evidence of life found on Mars. There have been false alarms. There have been anomalous findings that have yet to be fully resolved, but we haven't found evidence yet. And we've found proof that there is some ice. There was probably more water in the past, which is really promising, but we haven't found anything yet.
Jamie, we have heard a lot recently about artificial intelligence, ChatGPT. How does machine intelligence play a role in our search for life elsewhere and what it says about us?
I think the way that it's going to be most useful is that these machine learning algorithms are fantastic at recognizing patterns in ways that humans can't. And so there's work being done now about using machine learning programs to sift through past SETI observations of radio signals from the cosmos in case there's a possible pattern or signal or proof of technological origin that human searching hasn't been able to find. There's also work using machine learning to figure out possible signs of life in terms of chemistry that's different from Earth's life. So even though it won't look familiar to us, machine learning can say this would be the signature of complex living chemistry in this very alien, in this very alien environment. There is also the question of if we were to find advanced aliens, would they have transcended biology to become a sort of machine intelligence? You know, whether it's that they've created machine intelligence far beyond, you know, ChatGPT, that then replaced the biological intelligence, or did they upload their consciousness into eternal machines, or are the biological aliens hanging out at home while they send their robot scouts out into the cosmos? Because, you know, robots are a lot less bothered by space travel than bodies are.
Drones.
Yeah, totally.
Jamie Green, our guest, the book, The Possibility of Life's Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos. Could it be possible that alien life is hiding from us? You mentioned Dyson spheres in your book, Jamie.
Yeah, so Dyson spheres are this idea that were popularized and named after the astronomer, mathematician, polymath Freeman Dyson, which actually come from a science fiction novel from 1937 called Star Maker that I love and was so glad to discover because of this. So Dyson pointed out that a very advanced civilization would need more power to fuel their technology. And the way that they might achieve this would be to get all of the energy given off by their star instead of just what lands on a planet. And to do that, you build a sphere or a spherical swarm of satellites all the way around the star to catch all of its energy. Again, this sort of, as you can tell, started in science fiction. Mm-hmm. And Dyson was just saying, this could be a thing to look for. And so sure enough, maybe a little less than 10 years ago, an astronomer at Penn State named Jason Wright said, okay, I'm going to look for it. And he did a research survey where he was looking at other galaxies, because he figured if you're powerful enough to build one Dyson sphere, you're probably powerful enough to spread throughout the galaxy and, you know, start siphoning off from a lot of stars.
Jamie, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Jamie Green, science writer and author of the new book, The Possibility of Life, Science, Imagination, and Our Quest for Kinship in the Cosmos.